Greetings, merfolks. I'm your host, Danny Washington, and welcome to season two of 21st Century Mermaids. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, and determination with a ton of swagger and style. Guests we feature are actively contributing to the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science, a global initiative that began in 2021 on a mission to create transformative ocean science solutions for sustainable development, connecting people and our ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid. Intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our beautiful big blue planet. I am thrilled to have Dr. Tierra Moore with us today on 21st Century Mermaids Season 2. We're going to start off first, Tierra, with your full name, pronunciation, all the things, the titles, and then we'll go into the questions.
I'm Dr. Tierra Moore, founder and CEO of Black and Marine Science. I am also a marine ecologist, and I'm the BIMS program lead at the Nature Conservancy. So my full-time job now is really trying to change the face of who people see as scientists, get more folks that look like me and you involved, and really show them that they can be in this field and have a successful career, but also a safe place to work that's not toxic, that's not isolating.
I love it. Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to have you on the show today, Dr. Tierra Moore. You are an inspiration on so many levels. You're bridging so many pathways for people, like you said, like us, to be a part of this wonderful field of marine science. And I think that it's needed now more than ever. And I love our story and how we were able to connect, you know, through the internet, through BIMS. But it was in the midst of the pandemic where, you know, people were searching for one another. And that was the very first time in my life that I was able to gather with more than just a couple of brown and black folks who are in the field and have good conversations, real conversations about our experiences, about our perspectives, and where we want to go in the future. And I think that's really exciting that you've built this wonderful community of people because it's very, very necessary. So thank you for being here with us.
Man. Thank you so much. That makes me so happy to hear. You know, when you're just working and grinding and trying to get stuff done, you don't know how it's being received. And I think it's so important from our community, you know, allies and people can say, oh, this is cute. This is so nice. But to hear from an actual Black marine scientist, like, this has been impactful. This has helped me. It's just like, we did it, Joe.
We did it. Yes, you did. Yes, you did. But no, it's I truly mean it. So I'm really excited to dive into the backstory and your story so we can hear a little bit about more about what has inspired you along your journey, because this podcast is all about women who are paving new trails for ocean conservation and leading us toward that wonderful goal that we've set for our global community to reach by 2030 to protect 30% of our beautiful ocean planet. So that is where we'll begin. So let's go back to the beginning, Tierra. What's your origin story? Where did you come from? And how did you get interested in the ocean in the first place?
Oh, goodness. All right, let's take it back, wind it back. So I wanted to go to college. You know, I didn't necessarily have that support. Folks hadn't been to college before, but I knew I wanted to go. I wanted to change the wave of things. So I was like, ooh, this ain't it for me. and so I knew if I was going to college, there was two options, right? You had to be a doctor or a lawyer. And so I wanted to be a doctor. I thought I wanted to be a pediatrician. And then I realized I didn't want to work with kids like that. So it wasn't going to work out. But I didn't want to change my major either because I was already taking all these classes. So I start taking other classes and I sign up for this tropical ecology course. And the only reason I signed up is because they were going to Costa Rica for spring break. So I'm like, ooh, free trip. Because I love a good free trip.
Me too. But,
yeah, you know, like, but we got there and we're like on a boat and we're collecting water samples and we're doing these experiments and there's senior scientists there. And I'm like, ooh, are y'all getting paid? Like, what's the situation? How do you get this life? Because here you are, you know, you're teaching students, but you're also chilling on an island. So
where does that work? Right.
So that was the first time in my life, and I'm a senior in undergrad at this point, where I realized that, oh, marine science could be a career, and it's cool when you do get to do these fun experiences. So I immediately came back and was like, I want to go to grad school. I want to become a marine scientist. I want to do this. And so when I was looking for grad schools, I had decided that I had wanted to go to a HBCU, or historically Black college or university, because the one I was at, Winthrop University, was a predominantly white institution. But I had pledged a sorority. I'm a Delta. And we had done like a lot of different shows and, you know, community service and outreach with different HBCUs. And so, you know, once I got there, I was like, what? You know, like, what is this? There's a whole school for Black people. Like,
who would have known? I know.
And so that was just really like a different experience for me to have. And so I decided I wanted to go to HBCU for grad school. And so now I'm looking at these schools for a marine science program. And I didn't realize quite a feat that was going to be. But I found a couple. And I decided on Hampton University in Virginia. I'm telling this story for all the little kids. There are all the folks in undergrad who think you're pigeonholed to one major, because what I did in my personal statement, they do read those. I put like, hey, I know I'm pre-med, but I took this one class and I want to go and be a marine scientist. Please accept me. I'm a good student. And they did. Now, they didn't give me no money though, but they was like, yeah, you can come. You can come. We not paying. But by the time I got there, you know, I got on campus, I went and talked to different professors, whose work I was interested in. And, you know, I found this one guy, Benjamin Suker, great dude. And he was like, okay, you want to do this? I can actually fund the rest of your time here. So I was like, oh, this is how this works. And so, yeah, that's where I'll say I became an actual marine scientist. I was doing work in the Chesapeake Bay, trying to understand nutrient pollution and how that leads to things like hypoxia or low oxygen, fish kills, algal blooms, all those is really like water quality initiatives that people talk about. I was out there doing, I'm like, you know, taking meters into the ocean, like looking around. So yeah, it was a really cool experience. So that's the origin.
I love it. And that's incredible that you started off at a tropical ecology course doing just what you decided to study. You were working on water quality issues. And so what was the best part of the experience being at an HBCU with, you know, the studies that you were doing? Did you get interesting reactions when people would ask you what your major was? Because I know from my own personal experience, I've had that happen. We're like, you study marine biology? Like, what? Like, you know, it's an interesting conversation.
It's so funny you say that, because there's the one side where even from, I'll say, like, white folks, we're like, oh, you a marine scientist, you can swim? What? And then there's from Black folks like, you a marine scientist? Uh-uh, girl, we don't do that. You know, so it's just like the two perspectives. Like, what are you doing? Are you trying to die?
Like, you're going out in that ocean? Are you crazy?
Yeah. You be out there. So there's that. I think the experience of being in the HBCU is twofold, really. And I'm glad you asked this question. It's because on the one hand, there was the community, the culture. Like, I'm talking about authentic Blackness. I'm talking about sis dressed up with heels to go to literature 101, like, you know, doing the max. So it was just the culture, just being around Black excellence. That was awesome. But what I noticed specifically in marine science is that while it was at an HBCU, it still was only one Black professor. So wow. It was like,
wow,
we're here. And so my advisor was at the one I mentioned, Benjamin Suker. He was a white man. He was a great ally, you know, supporter, down for the people, but it was still a stark difference. And I think that's for me when I realized this idea or the concept of lack of diversity or the lack of people who look like me. Because I think for that time until then, I was just riding on passion. I'm like, yo, I'm about to do this cool thing. Like, this is exciting. You know, I didn't realize that there was going to be this stark difference of people not expecting me to be there. And when I got in the room, they didn't expect me to excel just because we weren't seen as that type of person or in that type of role. So I think I started to realize it there in Hampton, like I said, having that one Black professor. But when I did my PhD, whoa, days when it was solidified. Okay.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes. Wow. 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 And then even having that experience, you were still motivated to go and pursue your PhD. What made you want to do that?
I'll be honest, transparent. There was still a piece of me that wanted to be Dr. Moore. It's like something I said, like, oh, I'm going to be a pediatrician. I'm going to be Dr. Moore. And then I found out about this PhD and I was like, oh, you can still be a doctor. Oh, well, let's do that one.
Let's do that. Yes.
Let's do that one then. So there was that. And then I had, you know, that experience in Hampton where I did feel like I had a great mentor. We, you know, I conducted my own research. I was able to publish a paper. So I was like, well, shoot, it's just a couple more years of this and y'all gonna be calling me Dr. Moore. Let's ride, you know? So I think it was just that empowerment that I did feel coming from there. And me just, again, having that internal of wanting this title for myself, if I'm gonna be 100. So.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think, you know, for sure, families and especially Black families, families from other countries are very keen on that idea of excelling in your education to the point where you have a doctorate. I mean, right. My family's Caribbean. And when, you know, when I was growing up, it was all about like, yeah, your options were a lawyer or a doctor. That's what you need to be. And, it, you know, to get that acknowledgement in society and to have that title meant the world because it meant that we made it. But yeah, it's brilliant that you persevered and you continued through your education. So where did you go for your PhD?
I started my PhD in one place, but I finished my PhD in another place. So there's the short condensed version of some foolishness. But yeah, I finished my PhD at UCLA, but I started at Old Dominion University. Largely, I went to Old Dominion University because something I noticed about the HBCU or Hampton was that we didn't necessarily have the resources that I needed to do the type of research I wanted to do. So I had to go across the water, drive, use my gas to go over to Old Dominion University, you know, predominantly white institution, and had these high-level labs and all this beautiful equipment and all these things to do the work that I wanted to do. And so I was like, oh, well, this program has a PhD in oceanography. Hampton actually had a scholarship bridge program. So if I got accepted to ODU, it was going to be like my tuition would be covered. I wouldn't have to worry about anything just because they didn't have a PhD program. So they wanted to make sure that the master students did have some version of a pipeline, even though it wasn't necessarily the best. Because now I get over there and it's rough. Like there's no one that looks at me at all. You know, at least I had the one Black professor. There's no Black professors. At least I had, you know, cohorts of Black students. There's none. It's just me by myself. Wow. Yeah. And then it was just rough. So yeah, one of those experiences where you're just like, I got to get out or something needs to happen. And that's ultimately what happened. And so it came to a point where I wasn't doing well just because of the toxic experience. And that led to me needing to be dismissed from the program. And so that was a really rough point in my career because it's like, well, dang, like what do you do next? Like there's nobody guiding me. I don't have any types of support. And I just felt really isolated and alone because like this was supposed to be my big dream. You know, like how you just said, like, yeah, I got kicked out of school. Like how they kick people out of school you paying for? What you mean? That's when I realized like, you know, that lack of diversity, very definitely lack of advocacy was a huge part of my story because, you know, they talked to me about it and it was like, oh, there's this route we can go through. There's this route we can go to, but you need like your advisor's support. And that's probably like telling you, you need, I don't know, signs, to, a signature from God, you know, like because it wasn't any support there in the lab. So he wasn't going to support me. You know, it is what it is. Like, I guess I'm out. And so luckily, I had done this program almost like a research undergraduate experience, but it was during my master's where I actually became scuba dive certified. And I did this project in Bali, Indonesia on the coral, like diving the coral triangle. And it was really cool. And it was through the University of California. And so at the end of the program, they're saying like, oh, if you apply to a UC school, you know, we can help support your education. And so at the time, that wasn't appealing to me because I had already been accepted to Old Dominion University. I'm like, oh, I don't need this. I am getting my PhD from here. I don't need you. Leave me alone. But someone else that I had done the program with, she was at Hampton at the same time. She actually applied to a UC school and was doing her program at UCLA. So once I got kicked out, I called her up. I'm like, girl, let me tell you what happened. You know, I tell her the story and she's like, T, you should see if you still qualify for that grant that we did, you know, that program. And if you get accepted to UCLA, they'll pay for it. I talked to the program. I talked with the advisors, told them the situation, told them what was going on, and was transparent about what the work I still wanted to do. You know, I believed in myself. It didn't hurt that I did have this funding that I was coming with, you know, wherever I went. And so, yeah, I was accepted into the program and did my PhD at UCLA.
That's incredible. Wow. And what's interesting is that that's not a singular story. I've heard so many people have that similar experience where they enter a graduate program and it is a completely hostile environment. The advisors Yes. are not there to guide, not there to uplift their students, but yet they're there just to publish papers and, you know, continue their research. You know,
and tokenized because they still had my photo on their website long after I left. I'm like, oh, really? It's not the one Black student y'all had and haven't had another one since.
Right. How does that make sense? No. And these situations need to be called out more often because it's unnecessary. It's not fair. And this is why we lack diversity in the higher, you know, ranks of academia, is because of these gatekeepers that continue to block this progress. And so that needs to change. And I'm so glad that you got out of the situation and was able to find another alternative. How did you manage your thoughts and emotions in that time when you had to transition to a new school? What kept you afloat during that moment where most people would probably be really, really down and just upset with themselves and wanting to give up? How did you overcome that?
Man, that is a great question. I think just life, you know, and food. I think I was just at a place where I was more like shocked, like, wow, this is happening. And then I also have to immediately go into problem solving mode. Cause like, what am I going to do? I done told my whole family I'm getting this PhD. Now I got to tell them I didn't get kicked out. They're going to look at me like, what does that even mean? Like, what? You know, so I'm immediately trying to like save the situation. I'm also living in Virginia. You know, there's nobody in my family there. So it was definitely alone. But I think it was just me knowing that I could do it, you know, knowing that I knew it was because of the situation I was in. You know, like I knew if there was better conditions, I could achieve this goal that I have, you know? And mm-hmm. so I think that's really just all what got me through. I think my belief in myself has really made me the most successful for sure. I'm like, oh yeah, I can do this. All right. Yeah. Let's go. And it's really, yeah, it's really been helpful. And I think it is from my background. You know, I grew up in some rough conditions and I want to go down the road of like, oh, this poverty, but it was that. And, you know, I was always like on my feet and trying to figure out the situation, like how are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? Thinking about bills, thinking about lights, thinking about food, such a big part of my life. Now I just eat all the food I can because I got the money for it, you know?
Right.
But it's like, I say that lightly, but like, this is like the trauma that I had to live with of being hungry. And now it's like, food. Give me all, you know, but it's just those things. So I think because of that background of like having to grind, having to be out, figuring stuff out, I was able to go right into this problem solving mode to get me out of this situation, right? I have to figure out how I'm gonna pay this rent. You know, I have to think about that. So what can I do? I thought, to be honest, I was just gonna go get a regular job. Like I was like, all right, school's not for me. Let me just go, you know, do something else. And so there was a point when I knew about the UCLA thing in the back of my head, but I didn't think it was going to be real.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot, especially coming from, you know, like you mentioned, the trauma that you experienced in your childhood. And you have to apply so much ingenuity and creativity, right, to just keep pushing forward to find other solutions. And I love that about you. I think that's incredible because not a lot of people have tenacity like that. They just don't. So that's a huge testament to your perseverance. That was obviously a huge obstacle in your life and your career. What about the triumphs? What would you say are the most recent triumphs that you are super proud of that you've accomplished?
Well, of course, Black and Marine Science.
Yes.
I tell this story because in 2018, I wrote an op-ed literally called The Only Black Person in the Room. And I talked about my experience as a Black Marine Scientist. I had just completed my term on a board of directors for an aquatic sciences organization. So a high level international board, I was elected as the student representative to represent the students, okay? But of course, I'm the only Black person on this board. So anytime a diversity initiative would pop up, Keith, what you got to say? People, you know, would ask questions like, well, what is the organization doing about the lack of diversity? And I promise you, I'm at the meeting minding my business, probably scrolling on Twitter, and the president gets up and like, well, we have Tiara, so we're doing initiatives for diversity. And I'm like, you know, snap my neck, like, hold up, I'm here to represent the students. I'm right. The student rep. Yeah. Y'all is the grown people.
Exactly.
I'm here trying to get extra drink tickets. You know, that's my job as the student, to make sure the students have drink tickets. I'm not here to do nothing and stuff. It was so eye-opening because if I have these grown people that have been in the field for all these years and they're looking at me when someone asks them about diversity, it's like, I got to do some work. I need to call this out. And so that's really what this paper was about, you know, about me talking about those experiences. But even as a board member, how I wasn't necessarily included in a lot of things, I was still, I could be walking around a meeting and somebody like, hey, can you go grab me some coffee? I'm like, what?
What?
No. I got a whole badge on. It's a different color. You see? These are the little things that just occur. And they're like, oh, but we have a Black board member. Okay, but, you know, and so I think for me to have written that, to been the only Black person in the room, and then to have Black and Marine Science, an organization filled with Black Marine Scientists, is just so heartwarming. I just like get to the edge of my seat and I'm like, girl, what did you do? Like, really? You know, because again, like I say this all the time, what I realize is that, yes, I wasn't the only Black person in the room, but there's thousands of rooms. So if there's one of us in each of those rooms, and guess what? We got Black and Marine Science.
That's what we got.
And so it's just been so fulfilling to meet new people. I feel like I go one place and there's this one person that's just waiting, just like, oh my gosh, Dr. Moore, thank you. I am so excited. I'm looking at the BIMS TV. I'm on the YouTube. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm just like,
So great. So great. Yeah, that's seriously. I mean, I hope you have that moment every day where you pinch yourself and you're like, wow, this is real. It's really happening because, you know, as kids, I know for myself, I would have done anything to see a Black woman working in marine science, whether it was on TV or in, you know, a local school or on a field trip, like anything. And I saw nothing but people who did not look like me. And that was chilling because, you know, I knew I had this calling toward this field, but didn't know exactly how to get there. And I just, oh my gosh, I would have just changed the game. So I'm incredibly happy that now we know that there are high school students, middle school students, college students, current college students that are able to have this community to tap into and to visualize themselves doing what they want to do in their future. Period.
Period.
So let's go back to like ocean conservation, you know, beyond building community through BIMS. How does your work encapsulate conservation concepts and bridging the gap between conversations in different communities to talk about why the ocean is important, number one, and number two, what we can actually do to contribute to protecting what's left. What part of your work includes that type of conversation?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think the beauty of Black and Marine Science and the movement that we've created is that we work hard to make the science that we're doing accessible to all. And I think for me, I didn't even realize that I was doing this, I think at first, just because of the community I come from. I could never go in there talking about nutrient pollution and eutrophication. You know, I had to always figure out how to communicate and break it down for my friends to be able to understand what my work was. So like thinking about ways to communicate science has just been a part of my nature. And now we're doing this on a larger scale with our BIMS TV on YouTube. So now we have Black marine scientists all over the world talking about their research that they're doing in a way that's accessible. You can see them. They're breaking it down. And so I think what's important is that we are spending the time really talking and trying to communicate to the communities that are going to be the most impacted. When you think about climate change, when you think about ocean conservation and all the impacts of that, those tend to impact Black and brown communities the most. And so if they're not even sure of what's going on or what marine science is or have a connection to the water, and then they're slowly being impacted by the water because of the treatment of others, then we're doing a huge disservice to that community. And I think that's what I realized in my own personal work as a marine ecologist. You know, you get these grants, they tell you to go work over here, and you're like, why are we working over here and not over here where the biggest impact is? Because they Black? Is this really it? And I think, you know, when you start realizing that, it's like, oh, okay, how can I use my power now? Because I can write my own grants. I don't really need y'all. So how can I say, hey, let's do science communication in frontline communities. Hey, let's go to these communities, boots on the ground, and work on educating the youth in this area. Let's go do a swim program to make sure that they know how to swim and aren't having a fear of the water so that they can become divers. You know, so I think it's really those targeted initiatives of saying, hey, I'm trying to recruit for diversity in the New York Times or whatever they be doing to recruit. You know, they're not going to HBCUs, they're not going to stuff where people are in the communities that they know are the most impacted, but they're talking about it, you know? So I think our work comes in where the types of how we're trying to make our work be seen. But then also I think the movement is really where we are choosing to work. And I think there has been a great almost moment of saying, hey, we can fix this. If they don't want to write grants over here, then I will, you know, I can write this. I can go take this project and do it here, you know? And I think that's been just exciting. So that's where I think BIMS is going. I think the largest vision is for us to have that facility, that research and outreach facility, for us to do the type of high level and innovative science in the areas that are impacted the most, for the people that are impacted the most, and really have this community that is engaged and excited about marine science. And they don't necessarily have to go get a PhD, but just having that connection to the water and the importance of protecting it and the need for it.
That's beautiful. Yeah. And on that note, as far as connecting with water and connecting with the ocean, we talk a lot about empathy here on 21st Century Mermaids. It's really this concept that Dr. Erica Woolsey, who's one of our co-founders, she's constantly pushing the idea of ocean empathy. How do we feel more connected to the water and to the planet itself? How do you think we can cultivate more empathy for the ocean on an individual and community level?
When I've, you know, been thinking about the ocean and the connection to the ocean, specifically for Black people, I've been trying to push for more truth telling, you know, more of us acknowledging historical trauma that is there for the ocean and that is ingrained in our roots. You know, I think about our ancestors who, you know, on slave boats and on slave ships, who made a conscious decision as they're thinking about their future, as they're thinking about what they have to look forward to, there was nothing, you know, so they chose their freedom by jumping into the ocean. So it's really hard to think about what that meant for them. You know, like they saw almost a beauty of the ocean, like this here will save me. This is a better freedom for me. And so to now be studying, trying to think about like why we're not there and nobody talks about that aspect, I think is very important. And I think for me, by understanding that and knowing that there is so much ancestral history there, it makes me want to protect it, makes me want to understand it, makes me want to be involved, because that is where we have a lot of history. So I think for people that they have to really see the ocean as more as just a place, but I don't know, like a being, a space. When I'm scuba diving, it's just the most perfect experience, because it's like, first of all, nobody's talking, okay? There's no foolishness going on. But you can just see the beauty of the water, how it can help you, how you're just like, you know, wait, like this light and floating. And it just really gives you a better understanding of what's there and the beauty of it. So I think, yeah, people just got to lose the fear, but I also don't want to, you know, jump over the fact of why there is fear, but how can we take that fear and really turn it into something that could be beautiful?
Wow, Tierra, I love that so much. And that's something that I've definitely thought deeply about as well. The transformation that can happen in water, in bodies of water, whether it's the ocean, rivers, lakes, for the Black community specifically, I think there's so much potential there because, yeah, like you mentioned, our ancestors who chose to jump in the water and drown rather than having to endure the pain and suffering that happened on those slave ships is profound.
They didn't necessarily know what was coming, but they knew it was about to be ratchet. Like they knew, like, they knew. Hey, if they got me in this boat like this, nothing good is going to come. And it's like, that's the fortitude, like that's the vision, you know, like that's the most profound like thing, like to be there and to just be like, nah, I'm not.
And then for those who survived, our ancestors who made it to the other side of the ocean, across that journey and the things that they had to endure and then having to carry that with them for the rest of their lives. And then it's passed on generation after generation, this idea of the ocean being a place of death, a place of pain. Why would anyone want to go step back into that situation? Like, please, like, right. No. And so it takes an incredible amount of courage for those who have ancestors who have experienced that to step back in the water and to go in. And you're one of them. I'm one of them. And it's like, we're the ones who are bringing the healing to our people. And it's so essential. And I think once we, like anything, when you face your fear, when you face the thing that causes you pain, acknowledge it, address it, and then resolve it. And that's what we need to do on a collective level. I believe that wholeheartedly, that if we get more people in our community in the water, learning how to swim, learning how to scuba dive, there's transformation that can happen there.
It is. It's just the most amazing experience. And I think you said the most important part is that healing. You know, I think we as folks of the African diaspora have just been left wounded. And then people who hurt us, like, no, we didn't. We ain't talking about that. That was somebody else. Like, what? Like, can you just say?
Say what it is.
You know what I'm saying? So I think there is that aspect of it. And so we're almost like continuously being gaslit or continuously have to just deal with this trauma, knowing that it existed, but can't really have a discussion about it because somebody's going to start crying. Somebody's going to, you know,
somebody's going to feel guilty. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody's going to get mad. And so it's just like, but why? I think that lack of conversation has continued to allow us to be where we are. I know for me in my career, there was a time where, you know, I'm just happy to be here. Let me just keep my head down. But no, it's like, no, we need to talk about this. We need to figure out an action. How many times do I have to tell you to Black children are 2 times more likely to drown before y'all go write, you know, like a policy, a procedure, give us some money, like
something,
you know, like, yeah, we just like to have the stat because we have it. Like,
no.
But nobody's going to do anything. And so I think when we have folks like us who can have use our platforms and say, hey, these kids are drowning. Why is nobody saving them? Why is nobody helping? Why are we not doing anything? It gets more power behind it. Because what I've just been heard, like, oh, well, y'all don't want to swim. Or no.
Or you don't want to get your hair wet. Or, yeah.
Oh, I guess my goodness, come on now. Wet. That is the crazy thing. Like, you don't think I get my hair wet? Really? I actually put these braids in specifically so I could get it wet.
Exactly.
This is why.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it seems like it's just showing us that fact that what you resist persists. And these conversations that you're talking about that need to be had, they need to be had. Like, we cannot continue avoiding them because it's just festering and it's continuing to transform into different things that we don't want to see in our world and our experience. We have to address it.
We have to. But for the UN decade, you know, we think about 10 years of planning, folks are talking about. Nobody's saying anything about this. Nobody's talking about this. Like, there's this one small skill set that people just, you know, refuse, like, to talk about as a skill for marine science specifically. Like, how can you talk about the decade of ocean science without including the people that would benefit from it? So even if you aren't a marine scientist, why are we saving the ocean if people can't swim and they can't go enjoy it? Like, what am I doing this work for?
Exactly.
So I think there is some, like, we have the power right now as we're doing all this show and tell for the 30 years and the 10 years and the 50 years and the 30%. Okay, but what about the people? Like, can we say 30% of, we're going to make sure we get those folks swim lessons? Is that something that we could be talking about in these huge initiatives that we are trying to say? And we need people to then get the benefits of our work, because at the end of the day, what's the point?
Exactly.
That's me. That's it.
No, that's brilliant. I love that. And it's a valid point that needs to be taken seriously, you know, when we have conversations about the decade of ocean science for sustainable development. I mean, the whole title, sustainable development, you're not going to sustain anything if you don't have the people who are impacted or are living in those areas actually involved.
Exactly.
And have the skill sets and the ability to do the conservation work that's needed. That's it. Whew, oh my goodness. I love that. I love that. That we went deep, and I just so appreciate your honesty and transparency. So now for some fun. As you know, this podcast features women we believe embody a spirit of a modern day mermaid, someone who works for ocean science, marine conservation. But I'm curious, what is your interpretation of a mermaid?
I mean, I immediately think of Ariel, and this is actually a fun fact, is that I didn't necessarily know, but I did have an Ariel doll. I remember she was always naked because I don't know, I lost a little bra, but she had this big, this big red hair, and I would carry her around. So I don't know if that was leading up to this, but Little Mermaid was like my favorite story growing up, in like a little movie under the sea, you know, the whole situation, like... It was my favorite. And so, yeah, I see a mermaid as, I don't know, the ocean queen, you know, like just down there running things, slipping about, you know, very powerful in the water, very skilled, someone who knows what she wants and goes to get it.
I love that. Yes, 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 yes. And how excited are you about the release of the new live action Little Mermaid coming out in 2023 with our girl Halle Bailey?
Yes, the Black Excellence. I mean, yes. I've seen the photos and I'm just like, yeah. I can't wait. I mean, I feel like I got to do something extra and have like a BIMS viewing of it. So yeah, let's stay tuned. Let's plan it out, Danny. Let's do it.
Let's plan something. Yes.
So a viewing of the situation, that would be great. Oh man.
Definitely. And on that note, how do you embody a mermaid in your day-to-day life?
How do I embody a mermaid? Well, I mean, I'm a woman who knows what she wants and goes and gets it. But I mean, I think for me, I'm more embodying my authentic self, you know, as a Black woman, as a queer woman, as someone who likes to go get her nails done, as someone who likes to get her hair, you know, and I think through that, it has allowed me to become this better mermaid, you know, because there was a shell I think I was in before when I was first entering this career, you know, with the straight hair and the little blazer. I got on a polo now, but it got bibs on it. But, you know, like just not myself, even changing up my dialect. You know, I'm from the dirty South, so this is how I talk. This is what it is. But I would put on a whole different little voice. And that just wasn't who I am, you know? So I think me embracing who I truly am, even allowing myself to explore my sexuality, that was something I didn't think I could do. Like, yeah, has given me my mermaid superpowers. And I'm just over here like, yes, rainbows and butterflies and all the stuff. So yeah.
Yes, that is such a perfect answer. So tell me your vision of our world, right? Our ocean planet. If you could change everything tomorrow, what would the world look like? What would you want it to look like?
Oh man. I mean, it would be, I imagine it's a beautiful blue ocean, the coral reefs colorful with the fish that are supposed to be there. I imagine, you know, it filled with people who look like us diving or people who are just excited about marine science and want to see everybody involved in it thrive. I think as a marine scientist, especially as a diver, you can visually see the degradation of coral reefs. Reefs I used to go to in the past are now covered with algae, or they have disease, or they're white because they've been bleached, all those things. And so just to see that come back, to see the beautiful Hawaiian reef be restored, you know? And I think because people are just like tourists and they don't have an understanding of like, this could be better. You know, I saw somebody pointing out a reef to me and I'm like, ooh, this ain't cute, but okay, you're very excited. Look at you, half of it's dead. Don't you see this? And I'm like, you know, raining on their parade. But I'm like, they don't understand. They just see this thing that's there. That would be my vision, is for folks to have that understanding, that the empathy that you said for the ocean, and want to work together wholeheartedly to protect it.
Well said. I love it. Tiara, you're the best. You're the best. Thank you so much. Oh my gosh. Yes. This is great. You just gave me all the energy, all the good energy. I appreciate you so much.
So to follow me, is just at Curly, C-U-R-L-Y underscore scientist, S-C-I-E-N-T-I-S-T. And that's on Twitter and Instagram. Black and Marine Science, of course, look us up, BIMS.org. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Black and Marine Science. Follow us on Instagram. That one is at Black in Marine Science. Twitter is at Black in Marsci. Unfortunately, Black Marine Science was too long. We had to change it. Twitter was petty. But anyway, so it's at Black in Mar, M-A-R-S-C-I. Then also, save the date, because the reason we got started was BIMS Week. That's where we met, Danny. BIMS Week 1.
That's
and
right.
And so BIMS Week 3 will be November 27th through December 3rd. I repeat, November 27th through December 3rd. So definitely mark your calendars. It is going to be virtual again. I can't wait for the first in-person BIMS week. It's going to be lit. But anyway, but for this one, it's still going to be virtual. We'll be online all week doing all types of things. But we want everybody there. I always say it's just, this is about celebrating authentic Blackness in marine science, but it's for everyone because everybody needs to see us so they can change how they see us, okay? So BIMS Week is for everybody, so spread the word. That's it. I think I did a lot, enough pitching. Oh, and always, you can always donate to support our work. We have a PayPal on the website, BIMS.org. All right.
Donate.
That's it. That's it.
I love it. "21st Century Mermaids" is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.